Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us. You've made it these 8 weeks on our journey through Anglicanism. I hope that you have discovered with me this week that the riches of this tradition that we know and love here at Holy Trinity. For the last several weeks, we've been talking about sort of those abstractions of Anglicanism, right? The creeds that we confess and the history. We got a little bit more concrete the last 2 weeks. We looked at the Daily Office and Holy Communion. This week we're going to talk about what happened when Anglicanism as a reality left England. Because all of that we've been talking about so far to date really is just the Church of England. And obviously we're not in England, so how did we get here? And what is our place here at Holy Trinity specifically, and within the Diocese of Cana East, within this thing we call the Global Anglican Communion, which we'll be talking about tonight. I'll just go ahead and preface this with an apology in advance. The reality of the Anglican Communion right now is very complex, and I hope to at least make some of that plain to you tonight, but I can't promise you that all the moving parts will be plain in one sitting. So if you have questions, I'm very happy to talk with you about it. I've spent the last several years of my life learning about all of this. It's only been very gradual, even for me, to understand how this all works. But the Anglican Communion is a complex animal, and even more so now that there are serious divisions which are straining it, and we'll be getting to that in a moment. This is the last session, so you can turn to page 45 in your readers that I prepared for you. I do encourage you, if you have them, to have them open in front of you as we make our way through it. This very first thing that I've included here, before we get into the nitty-gritties of the communion itself, is this so-called Chicago-Lambeth Quadrilateral. And we talked about it a few weeks ago. And I think that this statement kind of stands in a sort of ironic contrast to what's become of Anglicanism in the last 100 years. Because when this statement was developed, there was definitely an emerging awareness among Anglicans, especially here in North America, that Anglicanism stood in a very unique place as a Christian communion between Protestant Christian bodies and what you might call the more traditional Christian churches, the Church of Rome and the Church of the East, the Eastern Orthodox Church. And I think that they began to understand that those unique aspects of what you might call Catholic faith, that Anglicans, through various accidents and intentions of their history, have retained, things like the historic episcopate, and a liturgy that's centered around the sacraments, unlike in many respects other Protestants, made them a fairly unique bridge between Protestants and these more historic traditions. Of course, Anglicanism also has some of those core convictions of the Reformation embedded within its life as well. And so Anglicans have had this emerging sense in the last 150 years that they stand in a very unique place to actually facilitate conversation between various Christian bodies. And so Anglicans, in many respects, were the first true ecumenists in the Christian world. Ecumenism refers to, ecumenical means universal. So ecumenical relations are talks between the various Christian communions about how we can work together and ideally even bring about reunion between these bodies that are separated. A lot of those hopes have not been realized in the last 50 years. We remain separated from Rome in the East and they from each other. And we from many of our Protestant brethren, at least officially. But those talks continue to go on. And in fact, just a couple weeks ago, within Rome, the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury set up a center in Rome to maintain open dialogue with Roman officials. They actually had, for the very first time in history, an Anglican evensong service inside St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, which is a fairly historic thing. And I saw videos of Roman prelates in their garb. You expect to see the men with the lace and the pink cassocks, and then Anglican bishops coming in with that quintessential Anglican look. And then I think it was a choir from one of the colleges in Cambridge actually sang the service. Not all that unsimilar from the service we're about to have here at Holy Trinity. So these are the kinds of things that Anglicans see themselves being in a unique position to do well. And this statement here is a statement of how the church can go about becoming one again, and as Anglicans, what those things we understand to be the core deposit of faith. And so you can see right at the bottom, those four bottom points. The Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testaments is the revealed word of God. The Nicene Creed is a sufficient statement of Christian faith. The two sacraments, baptism and supper of the Lord, or the Eucharist, and the historic episcopate, locally adapted in methods of its administration to the varying needs of the nations and peoples called of God into the unity of his church. As far as Anglicans are concerned, these are the four essentials of the church that you can't have any idea of reunion without these things. And I think, again, where Anglicans may be unique from other Protestants is this fourth item here, this historic episcopate, which we understand to be one of the graces that God intends his church to have. So this was adopted by the Episcopal Church House of Bishops in 1886, and then it was adopted again by a Lambeth conference in 1888. And that's a helpful segue into what we're going to talk about the rest of the night, a Lambeth conference. What the crap is that, is the question. Anglicanism is descended from the Church of England, right? The product of the Protestant Reformation within the bounds of England and the United Kingdom. And so at some point, Anglicanism moves on from there and becomes a worldwide phenomenon. And for those of you who even have just a partial understanding of history, it's not hard to understand why. You remember that famous phrase about the British Empire, the sun never sets upon it. That's because the British went everywhere. They colonized Africa, they colonized South Asia. Of course, they colonized North America, Canada, the United States. And so the British, when they traveled to all these places and set up colonial governments in these places... And we don't have to get into the politics of colonialism right now. It's just we're talking about the facts of history. When Englishmen went to these places, they, of course, took their church with them. And they set up Anglican churches in these places. The first church sort of outside of the official church of the Church of England was actually within the British Isles. It was the Church of Scotland. Because the established church in Scotland was not Anglican, it was Presbyterian, the Kirk. So the Episcopal Church of Scotland became, in that sense, the first sort of forays of Anglicanism outside of the official structures of the Church of England. The next major development of an independent church was the Episcopal Church here in the United States. And we looked at the preface of the American Prayer Book a couple weeks back, and the major reason why the Church of England here in the British colonies became a separate independent church is because of why. The revolution, right? These states became independent states. And so it was no longer appropriate to have a church within these new states, these new independent states, that was still answerable to the British monarch, as of course the Church of England is. And so they established their own independence. And what we now call the Episcopal Church was born in 1789 at a convention which took place at Christ Church in Philadelphia. And for those of you who are sort of watching the progress of this, Christ Chapel that they're building at the college is named after Christ Church because a lot of the founding fathers worshiped there when they were at the Constitutional Convention. It's just a couple blocks away from Independence Hall there in Philadelphia. It's one of the most historic churches in the United States. But then, of course, the churches started growing up all over the place, and to Anglicanism's credit, they tried to make the church indigenous. And so one of the first great success stories actually concerns what has now become the Church of Nigeria. There was an effort to evangelize the native Nigerian people. Of course, back then, Nigeria was a colony of the British government. And you had all these various tribes within Nigeria, the Igbo and the Yoruba and the Hausa and all the many tribes that make up that country now. And they attempted to evangelize them. And once there was a little bit of a critical mass, a black man who was a liberated slave by the name of Crowther went to London and was consecrated a bishop. And he became the first indigenous African to be ordained a bishop in the Anglican Communion. And he was ordained for one purpose, to evangelize his countrymen in West Africa. And that's what he did. And in fact, one of the premier seminaries in the Church of Nigeria today is named after Crowther. He's very much a revered man in that country. But as these churches began to develop and began to become very indigenous, as they did in Nigeria and other parts of Africa and other parts of Southeast Asia, there was this sense that we all have this common heritage. We all descend from the Church of England. We all have bishops who are consecrated through the lines of succession in the Church of England. Most of those provinces, until relatively recently, were using the 1662 as their, the prayer book of the Church of England as their prayer book. And so there was this sense that we have a common identity. But all of these churches were independent of one another. They weren't answerable to answerable to the Church of England or the Archbishop of Canterbury. They were all nationally autonomous churches, self-governing churches. And so, how does a church that's self-governing say in Nigeria or in Kenya or Uganda, communicate with the church that's self-governing here in the United States, the Episcopal Church, or with the mother church and the Church of England? How do we facilitate conversations between these bodies? And this is how the Anglican Communion as an idea began to be born. We have all these churches around the world now which are doing ministry in their own places, in their own, according to the dictates of their own cultures. But we all descend from a common root, and we're using a common form of life and discipline. How do we facilitate conversation? And so what was born just kind of organically over time were what are called the instruments of unity or instruments of communion. And these are official means by which these independent Anglican churches around the world, which are called provinces. That's kind of a key term, so I'll just write it down here for you. A province is an independent national church within the Anglican Communion that's entirely self-governing. So the Episcopal Church in the United States is a province of the Anglican Communion. The Church of Nigeria is a province. The Church of England is a province. Provinces tend to be headed up by senior bishops called archbishops. Not always. The Episcopal Church, the head bishop is called the presiding bishop, because we're good Republican Americans, we don't believe in those medieval institutions. But it's the same basic idea that the head of each church is an archbishop. They're often called primates, from the Latin word for one, the first. Not from monkeys, from primus in Latin first. So the head bishop of the church. But they're independent. And so we have to have some kind of official means of talking between each other. And of course, the most important instrument of communion or instrument of unity that allows sort of a common heritage to exist between these provinces is, in fact, the Archbishop of Canterbury himself. Of course, the Archbishop of Canterbury is the head or the primate and metropolitan of the Church of England. And for those of you who know your church history, Canterbury is in the very southeastern corner of England. That's why when Gregory the Great, Pope Gregory the Great in the 6th century, sent a mission to the British Isles to evangelize the Angles who lived in that part of England, he sent a man named Augustine, not to be confused with Augustine of Hippo, who's the great saint you probably know about, another man named Augustine, who settled at Canterbury, which was the capital of the Kingdom of Kent at that time, and began his work. So this was the first a bishopric to be erected in England that was in communion with Rome, which established it. So the Archbishop of Canterbury is a very important position within the Church of England, and basically any of the bishops around the world which he considers himself to be in communion with is a definition of Anglicanism. You know, the bishops in Nigeria or Kenya or Uganda or here in the United States, they're in formal fellowship with him. And so they share sacraments, they share holy orders. And so if a priest from the Diocese of Canterbury or any of the dioceses in England goes to Nigeria or Kenya or Uganda in the United States, he doesn't need to demonstrate his credentials to the church that's there because he's Anglican and he's in fellowship with the Archbishop of Canterbury. Any bishop who's also in fellowship with the Archbishop of Canterbury will immediately recognize that man's ministry. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, despite being the Archbishop of Canterbury, that's a city in southeastern England, he spends most of his time in London, which is a little further north. And that's because he's got a whole church to run and because of his important role within the communion. And he lives in London in a place called Lambeth Palace. Lambeth Palace is right across the River Thames from the Houses of Parliament. And that's where the Archbishop of Canterbury spends most of his time. So the Archbishop of Canterbury, himself being one of the instruments of union, his office in England, it's important again to stress here, he doesn't have authority over the other churches. He's considered, I have it written here in your notes, primus inter pares, first among equals. He's the head of the Church of England. He can't dictate terms to any of the other Anglican churches. But because he's the head of the Mother Church, he has a certain moral authority that's fairly significant, fairly weighty. He decided, the Archbishop of Canterbury at that time, I don't have his name here, but he decided in 1867 to establish a decennial conference, or a conference that takes place every 10 years, where he would invite all the bishops around the world with whom he considered himself to be in communion to come to England, to come to Lambeth Palace, and talk about issues of common concern for Anglicans. And that conference is known as the Lambeth Conference. And it's the second oldest of the instruments of communion. It's named obviously after the palace where the Archbishop of Canterbury lives. And those have been happening every 10 years since 1867, with two crucial exceptions. Anybody want to guess the two times? Well, now there's three, but let's set the third time to the side for the moment. The only two times until recently the Lambeth Conference was canceled in England. Anybody want to venture a guess? The World Wars. World War I and World War II. It didn't happen. Those are the only times since 1867 that the conference was not convened. So fairly significant world events are what it takes to keep this conference from happening. As the communion continued to grow, especially in the mid-20th century, there was an explosion of growth in Africa as these churches there really began to come into their own and evangelize their own people. Having now been to Nigeria twice myself, I can tell you the Nigerian church is Nigerian. When I was there with Bishop Julian, both times I was there, we were the only white faces in a crowd of several thousand Nigerian people. So that church is now thoroughly indigenous, and it's the same in Kenya and Uganda and the other provinces. And then there was, of course, the East African revival, which caused explosion in the churches of Kenya and Uganda. There was an explosion, and the community just is getting bigger and bigger. And so it was decided we need something in addition to these things to sort of continue ongoing conversation. And so the next instrument of unity was erected by a resolution of a Lambeth Conference, the Lambeth Conference of 1968, called into existence what's now known as the Anglican Consultative Council, or the ACC for short. It's often just referred to as ACC in news stories that talk about it. And the Anglican Consultative Council is the only democratically elected instrument of communion. So all the provinces of the Anglican Communion elect delegates to serve on the ACC for fixed terms. And there's a mix of clergy and laity that form that body. And that body meets historically once every three or so odd years or so. But one of the ways they keep ongoing conversation going is that the ACC manages in London the Anglican Communion Office. It's not a separate instrument. It's just basically the standing committee of the ACC. It's called the ACO for short. And this body plays a very pivotal role in recognizing new provinces of the Anglican Communion. So when churches come into their own and become large enough to really kind of be independent, there's a process whereby they become independent, and then they apply to the ACC in particular for admission or recognition as a province of the Anglican Communion. And the Anglican Communion Office is one of the key bodies to maintain constant conversations going on. And this is not an insignificant point. This body, it tends to be funded, the ACO, by money from Western churches, which tend to be the oldest and most well-endowed of the churches in the Anglican Communion. That becomes a problem, as we will see. The most recent instrument of communion to be established, this is relatively recently, 1979, by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Donald Coggan, what he called as a forum for leisurely thought, prayer, and deep consultation, is the Primates Meeting. Primate, as I've said, does not refer to monkeys. A primate is a head bishop or archbishop of a national Anglican province. And so there are currently 38 provinces of the Anglican Communion, so there are 38 primates. And when the primates get together, they, as this suggests, they talk about issues of concern. And there's been some conversation of late, not least caused by some of the conflicts that have now erupted, between these two bodies here, the ACC and the Primates Meeting, about who has authority over what. And there was a Lambeth resolution a number of years ago where a special sort of prerogative was given to the primates to weigh in on what at the time was called legitimate limits of Anglican diversity. Because by the time you get to the later 20th century, the Anglican provinces are beginning to diverge fairly significantly from one another on issues of core doctrine, especially the Western churches and especially the Episcopal Church here in the United States. And so there's already beginning to be tensions, even in the 70s and 80s, over some of these divergences. And the Primates Meeting was in part empowered to weigh in some kind of mildly authoritative way on what legitimately constituted a spectrum of options for Anglicans, and are there limits to what Anglicans can believe and still be Anglican? The primates were also given, at least in theory, additional oversight over how to admit new provinces to the communion, to formally advise the ACC on whether they thought a province should be admitted as a new province. That power has been very much debated in the last few years, and the ACC has jealously guarded its prerogative to formally recognize provinces, though the primates also have said, no, we, according to a Lambeth Council resolution, we also have a pretty key voice. And this highlights a problem for Anglicans, which has made our situation nowadays a little worse. And that's that these four instruments of communion, not only can they not officially tell other Anglican provinces around the world what to do, they also can't tell each other what to do, right? So you've got a multiple-armed organism here that the right hand literally doesn't always know what the left hand is doing. And in theory, the Anglican Communion Office, or the permanent secretariat of the ACC in London, is supposed to facilitate ongoing dialogue between the provinces and the instruments. But as tensions and relationships have become more and more strained in the communion, that has broken down. And it's not always been clear when a primates meeting comes up with some communique or recommendation, the ACC is not bound to follow it. And that happened relatively recently, in January, when Archbishop of Canterbury convened all the primates in London and said, how are we going to solve this schism which has erupted in the communion? And they had a couple of formal recommendations. One of them was that the Episcopal Church would not have full representation on this body. But when this body met in Tanzania, only 3 months later, the Episcopal Church delegates were seated with full voice and vote. And the primates called foul. They said, we just agreed that they would not have that. But they did anyway. And the Episcopal Church broadcast that very widely. Hey, we sat down with full voice and vote. Nothing happened with that meeting in January. We still are full, we're full Anglicans. And this inability of the instruments to work together has caused a problem. Now, when these instruments were erected, especially these first two, Anglicans were all using the same Book of Common Prayer for the most part. The faith was pretty constant between them. And so mechanisms for discipline between the provinces weren't erected because they weren't needed. Anglicans just agreed with each other on these things. But as they've begun to disagree more and more with each other, the lack of ability to enforce some kind of standard has strained these instruments beyond their ability to bring about resolution. And that's what's precipitated the crisis in the communion as we see it today. A couple of key dates, if you turn just quickly ahead in your things here, I put for you on page 54 and 55. This is kind of a history of how the communion has become more and more strained over time. You notice it goes all the way back to the 60s, when the first thing I have on this list here, and this is just a very selective list, it becomes a bit more exhaustive towards the end, but these early dates, there's a lot going on in between. A man named James Pike, who was the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of California, is just a flaming pagan. I mean, I'm not just being mean-spirited. He really was a polytheist. At one point, his daughter died of a drug overdose, and he decided to nationally broadcast a seance he conducted with a medium to commune with his dead daughter. And he was wearing his collar when he did that. Very, very liberal. A number of bishops within the Episcopal Church formally brought him up on charges according to heresy canons, which, ironically enough, are still technically on the books within the Episcopal Church. But the College of Bishops and the sort of governing councils of the church at that time didn't, quote, want the bad publicity of a heresy trial. And so Bishop Pike was exonerated without trial on four separate occasions and continued to be a bishop of good standing in the Episcopal Church. He finally went on some kind of spiritual journey in the Judean desert and got lost and died. So the man was literally kind of crazy, but he was a bishop in the Episcopal Church who, despite efforts of conservatives at that time still in the Episcopal Church to bring him up on charges, they couldn't do it. In 1976, the General Convention of the Episcopal Church made a couple of key changes to that church's constitution and canons, which produced one of the first major exoduses of the Episcopal Church. One of them was to ordain women to the presbyterate, to ordain women priests. And the next was to get rid of the 1928 prayer book, which is what we use here, and replace it with the 1979 Book of Common Prayer, which was a fairly radical revision of Anglican liturgy, which up to that point had always kind of changed rather slowly and gradually. The transition from 28 to 79 was fairly significant. And so at that time, a number of churches came out of the Episcopal Church and formed a new church in St. Louis called the Anglican Church in North America, which immediately fractured into all these little different churches. And those churches are called the Anglican Continuing Churches. And until relatively recently, Holy Trinity Parish here in Hillsdale was a member of one of those continuing churches called the Episcopal Missionary Church. So the continuing churches have their origins with the Congress of St. Louis in 1977, after that fateful General Convention of the Episcopal Church. Moving much more quickly here, you look at this date in 1997 and 1998. Issues of human sexuality are becoming more and more prominent within the communion, and a number of conferences are being held around the world to talk about it. And one of them was a conference between the provinces of the Global South. And these are provinces which tend to exist south of the equator. And they all also tend to be fairly conservative. Not all of them, but most of them are fairly conservative churches. And they were concerned about shifts in doctrine happening in the West. And so they issued a statement, the Kuala Lumpur statement, saying that the Bible is unequivocal and clear, and that deviations from biblical standards of sexual morality are deeply concerning and totally unacceptable. A year later, a Lambeth conference, Lambeth 1998, passed a resolution, which is very, very important, called Lambeth 98 Resolution 110. And in that resolution, it affirmed the Kuala Lumpur statement. It affirmed a previous resolution from another Lambeth conference, and articulated in very clear terms the standard Christian position on human sexuality, that sex is properly exercised between a man and a woman and a lifetime covenant of marriage. And that was a statement that came from one of the core instruments of communion. Again, it's not binding. It's just a recommendation to the provinces. But the provinces are all at this meeting, and so they're coming up with these ideas together. And it called on the primates, I was mentioning this before, to intervene to define the, quote, limits of diversity on questions like this within the communion. So the primates of the communion point to resolutions like this or conferences like this to say why they have power over some of these things. But things continue to deteriorate, and in 2000, something very fateful happened. And before I describe quickly what this was, Anglicans have inherited in their understanding of the church from ancient times the idea that the church exists in a place. And that place is, in that sense, sacrosanct to that church. So the bishop of an area is the only representative of the church in that area. His diocese, in that sense, is sovereign. And you can't have overlapping bishops in that area, because that's not how classical Christian polity with bishops works. England is that way. All the Anglican provinces are that way. So you don't go into another bishop's territory if you're from another diocese or another province without first gaining that bishop's consent to be there. And if you're going to do long-term ministry in that diocese, he has to license you to do that ministry. It's part of the way Anglicans express holy order. You know, if we're going to go into an area where the church is already established, we're Anglicans, we submit ourselves to the Anglican church in that place. But in the year 2000, something very, very significant happened. A number of primates in the communion, specifically the Archbishop of, the primate of Southeast Asia, a man named Moses Tay, and the primate of the Anglican Church in Rwanda, a man named Emmanuel Collini, ordained an American Episcopal priest named Chuck Murphy a bishop and sent him back to the United States to do missionary work in the U.S. And they crucially did not ask the Episcopal Church for permission. So when Chuck Murphy came back to the United States, now no longer an Episcopal priest, but an Anglican bishop, consecrated by Anglican bishops overseas, the Episcopal Church immediately cried foul. You can't do that. And they weren't necessarily wrong. That is a violation of classical polity. But they did it because people were beginning to leave the Episcopal Church over continuing slides into false doctrine in that church without consequence. And a number of Anglican churches within the Episcopal Church at that time one of the most significant of which was Chuck Murphy's church, a place called All Saints and Pauli's Island in South Carolina. So we can no longer participate in this. We want out. But we want to be Anglican. We want to be attached to the Anglican Communion. We don't think the Episcopal Church is now a faithful representative of the Anglican Communion. So we want out of TEC, T-E-C, the Episcopal Church. But we want to stay in the Communion. And Southeast Asia and Emmanuel Collini in Rwanda said, we will ordain a bishop for you. And by doing that, they were basically saying, we no longer recognize the ministry of the Episcopal Church as legitimate. And that was a huge thing to do. 3 years later, they weren't proved wrong by how bad things had become, because another very fateful thing happened. A man in an openly partnered gay relationship, a man who had a wife and children he was divorced from, was consecrated a bishop of the Diocese of New Hampshire in the Episcopal Church. His name was Gene Robinson. And as soon as that happened, the Archbishop of Canterbury himself convened an emergency meeting of the primates and said, what are we going to do about this? And that primates, that unofficial meeting of primates put out a statement saying that they were very concerned about this and that the actions of the Episcopal Church had, quote, torn the fabric of communion at its deepest level, unquote. And something has to be done. They set up a commission to study the issue and write up a report for the communion about how they were going to respond to this. Around that same time, a number of conservatives still within the Episcopal Church, and including some whole dioceses, decided we gotta stick together more officially than we have to date. And they formed an organization within the Episcopal Church called the Common Cause Partnership. And these are bishops of like the dioceses of Pittsburgh, South Carolina, Albany, and New York, and elsewhere around the U.S. saying, we're going to band together and work together to either bring about reform or to do something else. It's important to note, again, this was from within. These are conservatives still in the Episcopal Church. In 2004, that commission that the Archbishop of Canterbury called in response to Gene Robinson's consecration produced a report called the Windsor Report by the Lambeth Commission on Communion. And it emphatically restated its commitment to that fateful Lambeth Resolution, 98.110, on human sexuality. But it called for a moratorium on the consecration of more gay bishops within the Anglican Communion provinces. But it also called for a moratorium on Anglicans consecrating bishops for services in other provinces. So they're trying to rein this in a little bit. A primates meeting now in 2005 convenes in Northern Ireland, and it reiterates the Windsor Report and asks the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church of Canada to voluntarily withdraw their representatives from meetings of these bodies for the next 3 years. I think that actually happened, but it didn't make any difference. The Episcopal Church consecrated another gay bishop in 2010, a woman named Mary Glasspool, as a suffragan bishop of Los Angeles. So they sort of ignored all of that, those things from the communion. Then there was another meeting of the primates in 2007 in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and they articulated a desire for a pastoral scheme whereby conservatives within liberal churches could have alternative episcopal oversight from conservative bishops from within either their own church or from overseas. And this idea was actually proposed by the Archbishop of Canterbury as a way to sort of bring about resolution, and it was the Episcopal Church that rejected that suggestion. So you have now here an examples of the Anglican Communion through these instruments articulating official Christian teaching and reaffirming it several times publicly. And the Episcopal Church has representatives at these meetings. So in theory, they're signing off on these communiques and recommendations and these reports that are coming out. But they continue to move forward with their revisionist theology. And so a number of provinces decided that they needed to also intervene the way Rwanda had a few years before. And in 2006, the Anglican Church of Nigeria formed the Convocation of Anglicans in North America, or CANA. And the man that they consecrated to run that was the Episcopal rector of a church called Truro in Northern Virginia, whose name was Martin Mintz. And Martin Mintz was Julian Dobbs' predecessor as the missionary bishop of CANA. 2008 is the next meeting of the Lambeth Conference. And the Archbishop of Canterbury has a very fateful decision to make. Who is he going to invite to this meeting? After all of these resolutions have been passed and the Episcopal Church and the Church of Canada have continued to make strides away from classical orthodoxy, who are we going to not invite those bishops? Are we going to invite bishops like Martin Minns, who were consecrated outside the Episcopal Church, to serve within their territory? The Archbishop of Canterbury decided not to invite those bishops. He also decided not to invite Gene Robinson. But he did invite all the bishops who consecrated these men as bishops. And it was sort of this halfway house compromise that nobody was satisfied with. Because it's like, well, you're not going to invite the guys, but you're going to invite the guys that ordained the guys? Like, how does that solve anything? And so in 2008, a group of Anglicans, mostly from the Global South, but including some Anglican and Episcopal clergy here in the United States, decided to have a meeting before the Lambeth meeting in London in Jerusalem to talk about what are we going to do about this crisis in the communion. And I invite you now to turn back to page 48 and the statement on the global Anglican future. This was put together by delegates that were meeting in Jerusalem in 2008, in the summer of 2008, in June. Lambeth occurred in August of that year, so it was a couple months later. And they decided we got to find some way to talk about what's going on in the Anglican Communion. And they say here, if you look at this just introduction, this movement is global. It has mobilized Anglicans from around the world. We are Anglican, 1,148 lay and clergy participants, including 291 bishops representing millions of faithful Anglican Christians. We cherish our Anglican heritage in the Anglican Communion and have no intention of departing from it. So they're not. So even though people are beginning to see that, is this conference happening in Jerusalem sort of an anti-Lambeth conference? These guys are stating quite emphatically, we don't desire to leave the Anglican Communion. We love the Anglican Communion. We are Anglicans, but we're deeply concerned about what's happened in the Anglican Church globally. Moving on to this global Anglican context, they identify two major trends which have become determinative of the state of the Anglican Communion at that time. The first trend is we rejoice in the way God has opened doors for gospel mission among many peoples. Right? So the growth of the global South. And this was dramatic. The Church of Nigeria, for example, went from having, I think, about 16 bishops in the late 1970s to 261 bishops now. And that was entirely through evangelism and church planting. I mean, I've been there, friends, and the bishops in the northern part of the country, especially where evangelism is still happening at rapid paces, they will not ordain you a priest until you've already planted a church. And they just kind of send you into these territories where there's no churches and say, build the church. And they give them motorbikes and they give them maps and they say, go. I had a friend who went to Kenya a few years back and he said that when new bishops are consecrated in Kenya, there may not be a diocese in the area where they're being sent to minister, they're basically given a motorbike and a map and they say, go build the church in this area. So these churches are growing by good old-fashioned evangelism and gospel preaching, and they're growing rapidly. Nigeria has 20 million members, Nigeria alone. Compare that with the Episcopal Church, which peaked in the 1960s at around 4 million. Right, so we're talking about a church that right now is five times as large as the Episcopal Church was in its heyday. It's considerably larger than the Episcopal Church now. So the growth of the Global South, which tends to be very orthodox and biblically conservative. That's trend number one. Trend number two, we grieve for the spiritual decline in the most economically developed nations, where the forces of militant secularism and pluralism are eating away the fabric of society, and churches are compromised and enfeebled in their witnesses. The vacuum left by them is readily filled by other faiths and deceptive cults. We're talking about the decline of the great Western provinces, the Episcopal Church, the Church of Canada, and increasingly now even the Church of England. They understand the Anglican Communion, being present in six continents, this is the very last paragraph of that page, is well positioned to address the challenge of the modern age. But because of these fights it's currently finding itself in, it is currently divided and distracted. And so the Global Anglican Future Conference, or GAFCON, as it's called, has emerged in response to this crisis in the Communion. A crisis involving three undeniable facts concerning global Anglicanism, and now they outline what they are. Number one, the first fact is the acceptance and promotion within provinces of the Anglican Communion of a different gospel, which is contrary to the apostolic gospel. This false gospel undermines the authority of God's word written and the uniqueness of Jesus Christ as the author of salvation from sin, death, and judgment. Many of its proponents claim that all religions offer equal access to God and that Jesus is only a way, not the way, the truth, and the life. It promotes a variety of sexual preferences and moral behavior as a universal human right. It claims God's blessing for same-sex unions over against the biblical teaching on holy matrimony. In 2003, this false gospel led to the consecration of a bishop living in a homosexual relationship, Gene Robinson, Bishop of New Hampshire. He's, by the way, divorced now from the man he was married to that caused this split. So thank you so much for your faithfulness, Gene Robinson. That's verse number one. And you'll notice here, this statement concludes on the theme of human sexuality, but it begins with an understanding of the authority of the Bible and uniqueness of Christ. And they see that as the core problem. Right? The reason why you guys have consecrated gay bishops is not because you read the Bible differently than we do, but because you don't trust in the Bible as a timeless word of God at all. And that's the root problem. As GAFCON has moved on from this statement, they've increasingly reiterated that point. And now they talk about their role in communion is, what they say is, to restore the Bible to the heart of the Anglican communion. Because they really do understand that as kind of the key issue. That's fact number one. Fact number two. The second fact is a declaration by provincial bodies in the global south that they are out of communion with bishops and churches that promote this false gospel. So Nigeria no longer recognizes the Episcopal Church as a legitimate Anglican church. So from Nigeria's point of view, for example, there is no Anglican church in North America because the Episcopal Church is now apostate. These declarations have resulted in a realignment. There's that key term. Whereby faithful Anglican Christians have left existing territorial parishes, dioceses, and provinces in certain Western churches and become members of other dioceses and provinces, all within the Anglican communion. So he's talking about when churches or parishes leave the Episcopal Church and then align themselves with another Anglican church overseas. Right? So they're no longer in the Episcopal Church, which is the recognized official Anglican province here in the U.S., but they have pastoral oversight from another Anglican province, which is an official Anglican province where they are. And how do we sort out these overlapping claims? These actions have led also to the appointment of new Anglican bishops set over geographic areas already occupied by other Anglican bishops, people like Martin Minns and Chuck Murphy. A major realignment has occurred and will continue to unfold. The third fact, and this is one of the reasons why I went through that history, is the manifest failure of the communion instruments. They're talking about these four things: to exercise discipline in the face of overt heterodoxy. The Episcopal Church USA and the Anglican Church of Canada, in proclaiming this false gospel, have consistently defied the 1998 Lambeth Statement on Biblical Moral Principle, Resolution 110. Right? They're appealing to official statements that these instruments have issued. Despite numerous meetings and reports to and from the instruments of unity, no effective action has been taken, and the bishops of these unrepentant churches are welcome to Lambeth 2008. To make matters worse, there has been a failure to honor promises of discipline. The authority of the primates meeting has been undermined, and the Lambeth conference has been structured so as to avoid any hard decisions. They're talking about the way when they got the agenda for the 2008 Lambeth meeting, the Archbishop of Canterbury at that time, a man named Rowan Williams, put together an agenda that basically prevented any actual conversation from happening. He used this fancy term called indaba, which is like had small group conversation. It was a tool basically to silence dissent, and the Global South people kind of sensed that was what was going on. That is, in fact, what happened. We can only come to the devastating conclusion that we are a global communion with a colonial structure. The Africans, in particular, are very sensitive to being talked down to by white Westerners. Right? These are churches that have become indigenous in their countries, and their countries, of course, have now become independent of the British Empire. And they don't like being talked down to by white people. Right? When Nigeria now has 20 million people showing up to church on Sunday, and the Church of England itself only has 1 million, Nigeria is saying to itself, why are we taking directions from you? You're not preaching the gospel anymore, and we are, and we're seeing lives transformed in our country. And yet, we consistently are sidelined in these meetings so that our voices aren't heard. Despite the fact that we keep winning, and these instruments keep producing documents which affirm classical orthodoxy, revisionism continues, and there's no discipline. At one point, there was an African-American bishop actually in the United States. Her name was Margaret Harris. She's an assisting bishop in Massachusetts. And she at one point implied quite publicly in this Lambeth conference that the African bishops were being bought off for a chicken dinner. And the idea was that, oh, they're just going along with these conservative Americans because they're getting money from them. They're not actually in this for principle. The Africans find that deeply offensive, wouldn't you? There was another situation a few years back when the Archbishop of Nigeria, at the time a man named Peter Akinola, was in a meeting of these Anglican primates, and Nigerians have a reputation for being kind of aggressive and forward as a people. That's just kind of the way they are. And one of the Western bishops said to him, because Nigeria has been one of the great stalwarts for Orthodox faith, you're just trying to play the man, sort of insulting him for his sternness. You're just trying to play the man. And Akinola responded, I'm not trying to play the man, but I'll no longer be treated like a boy. And so you're seeing strained relationships between Western churches and these Africans who don't like being talked down to, especially when they're being talked down to by people who at one time gave them the gospel of faith and have now abandoned that same faith that they gave them. Right? The Nigerians remain very thankful for the West and its efforts to evangelize them. But when they look back on what the West was and what it's become, they grieve for what's happened, what's been lost. Sadly, this crisis has torn the fabric of communion in such a way that it cannot simply be patched back together. And at the same time, it has brought together many Anglicans across the globe into personal and pastoral relationships and a fellowship which is faithful to biblical teaching. So now they're deciding, what are we going to do? We're at this place. What are we going to do? Turning to page 50. Second paragraph there, beginning with our fellowship. Our fellowship is not breaking away from the Anglican communion. We, together with many other faithful Anglicans throughout the world, believe the doctrinal foundation of Anglicanism, which defines our core identity as Anglicans, is expressed in these words. And for those of you who remember a slight change we made to our constitution and bylaws in this parish, you'll notice this is where I got that language. The doctrine of the church is grounded in the Holy Scriptures and in such teachings of the ancient fathers and councils of the churches are agreeable to said scriptures. This language will seem familiar to you all now that we've walked through this course together these past few weeks. In particular, such doctrine is to be found in the third and articles of religion, the Book of Common Prayer, and the Ordinal. These are the three classic formularies of Anglican identity, our liturgy and our articles. We intend to remain faithful to this standard, and we call on others in the communion to reaffirm and return to it. Notice what they say next, because this is a big thing. While acknowledging the nature of Canterbury as a historic see, we do not accept Anglican identity is determined necessarily through recognition by the Archbishop of Canterbury. This is a shot across the Anglican communion's bow. Because what you see emerging within the communion today are two competing definitions of Anglican. The one definition is solely institutional. Those churches which descend from the Church of England by bishops and who have, by historic circumstance, representative on these councils, who are through them in fellowship with the Archbishop of Canterbury. That's it. Common faith and heritage doesn't really matter. You know, the Episcopal bishop can believe nothing of classical Anglican belief, but because they're a bishop of a diocese which is historically Anglican, they're Anglican. That's all that matters. Right? So that's one definition, a purely institutional definition. The second definition is a definition of Anglicanism, which is defined by our core theological standards. Our prayer book and our articles going back to the time of the Reformation and our commitment to the Catholic faith of the early church. Those things that we've been talking about these last several weeks. What makes Anglicans Anglicans? The fact that we exist in these historic succession things, or the fact that we believe and do what Anglicans have historically believed and done? GAFCON is unanimously clear. Anglican identity is defined by the latter and not necessarily by the former. And while we don't deny the validity of bishops and the idea of historic succession, of course, how could we? This conference that's writing this statement is Anglican bishops and clergy in council together. They're not overthrowing the importance of historic succession in the episcopacy. But they're saying that the episcopacy itself as an institution bears witness to a truth which precedes it and defines it. And that's the truth of our faith as Anglicans. So if people depart from that standard, even if they're in these old historic churches with great endowments and cathedrals, they're no longer Anglican, and sadly, some of them may not even be Christian anymore. They can't even get up and affirm Jesus Christ as the way of salvation. So, building on the above, this is the bottom of that paragraph, building on the above doctrinal foundation of Anglican identity, we hereby publish the Jerusalem Declaration as the basis of our fellowship. And what follows are 14 points. They say, if you submit to these 14 things, you're an Anglican, and we will lock our arms with yours and go forward together in ministry. And their definition is overwhelmingly theological and not merely institutional. The historic episcopates in here Right? They're not unconcerned about maintaining historic continuity. But like I said, they see that continuity as itself bearing witness to a truth which precedes it and defines it, and not the other way around. Right? Just because you're a bishop, you can't just change the teaching of the church. And if you do that, you're no longer really a bishop, whatever you may say. And this approach to conflict in the church is actually very ancient. This is the way the early church, when they wrestled with doctrine, would handle it. Now, a bishop would teach false teaching, and the bishops gathered together would say, well, we no longer recognize you, and they erect a new bishop in your place. Sometimes those bishops would step down, sometimes they wouldn't, and you'd have schism in a local place. But the pattern is actually quite ancient. Moving forward now, I encourage you to read these 14 points. I won't read them now for the sake of time, but the road ahead, we believe the Holy Spirit has led us during this week in Jerusalem to begin a new work. We, the participants of the Global Anglican Future Conference, GAFCON, do hereby acknowledge the participating primates of GAFCON who have called us together and encourage them to form the initial council of the GAFCON movement. So they want the GAFCON primates to form a new primates council. We urge the primate council to authenticate and recognize confessing Anglican jurisdictions, clergy and congregations, and to encourage all Anglicans to promote a gospel and defend the faith. They're basically erecting right now a new instrument of communion. They're creating a fifth instrument, which is the GAFCON movement based on the Jerusalem Declaration. We recognize the desirability of territorial jurisdiction for provinces and dioceses of the Anglican Communion, except in those areas where churches and leaders are denying the Orthodox faith or are preventing its spread, and in few areas for which overlapping jurisdictions are beneficial for historical or cultural reasons. We thank God for the courageous actions of these primates and provinces who have offered Orthodox oversight to churches under false leadership, especially in North and South America. The actions of these primates have been a positive response to pastoral necessities and mission opportunities. We believe that such actions will continue to be necessary, and we support them in offering help around the world. We're going to keep consecrating bishops in other provinces if those provinces refuse to repent. Basically, that's what they're saying right here. And then we get to this last paragraph here that I'll read to you. And it's the reason why, somebody asked recently, why are we at Holy Trinity aligned with the Anglican Church in North America through Cana? Why bother with this province? They do some things we don't like in some dioceses of the ACNA, they ordain women. And we don't agree with that here, so why do we bother with the ACNA? It's kind of a mess. This is why. We believe this is a critical moment when the Primates Council will need to put in place structures to lead and support the church. In particular, we believe the time is now ripe for the formation of a province in North America for the federation currently known as the Common Cause Partnership to be recognized by the Primates Council. Why does the ACNA exist? Because a bunch of upstart Americans said, we're done, we're going to start a new church? Because GAFCON called us into existence. When the bishops met together in Jerusalem 2008, they said, American Anglicans, form for yourselves a new province and begin to rebuild the church in your country. And we will support and recognize you and provide whatever aid you may need. And that's now what happened. The very following summer was the first general meeting of the ACNA. It met in Texas, and our province formally adopted its first constitution. Cana was one of the founding members of the ACNA, as were a number of the Episcopal dioceses that left that church. A whole diocese, you know, a whole bishop and a whole bunch of churches all at once left. Pittsburgh, San Joaquin in California, Fort Worth in Texas, and Quincy in Illinois were the four main ones, and now the Diocese of South Carolina, which has just voted to join the ACNA. Diocese of South Carolina, for the record, is one of the nine founding dioceses of the Episcopal Church way back in the 1780s. And some of the parishes of that diocese have deeds to their property which date back to colonial charters. So it's one of the oldest, and now I think officially the largest diocese within the ACNA. This is why we exist. This is why the ACNA exists. The ACNA is not perfect. I'll be the first to admit it. It was created during a crisis climate. And so they made a few exceptions to classical holy order to bring a lot of these Anglican groups together under one umbrella. So right now within the ACNA, we have overlapping dioceses and jurisdictions. We don't have a common prayer book, so there's a number of authorized liturgies. Some dioceses ordain women and some dioceses don't. Some dioceses don't ordain women at all. Some dioceses, like Cana East, will ordain women to be deacons. So there's issues that still need to be resolved, and it's kind of messy. And some people get a little frustrated sometimes, like, why do we bother? We bother not because the ACNA is a shining star of perfection, but because the ACNA right now is GAFCON's attempt to rebuild the church in this country, the Anglican Church. And as long as they're in fellowship with the ACNA, I'll be in fellowship with the ACNA. And that really is my conviction. As long as the Nigerians and the Kenyans and the Ugandans and the Rwandans and the Southeast Asians and the Middle Eastern Anglicans are behind us and recognize this church as the official church in America that they're in fellowship with, I will be in fellowship with the ACNA. And I pray and I hope that they can resolve some of these issues, which I hope they will do. And they're making steps, but it's going to take time. And the dust hasn't quite yet settled. We're talking about a major realignment which has occurred. And one of the things the ACNA done, and especially the ministry of our own Bishop Julian Dobbs, is to reach out to churches like Holy Trinity, who are beginning to discern whether or not we want to align ourselves with a more mainstream Anglican body. Because, of course, you guys came out of the Episcopal Church before there was another real major alternative. Certainly one that was recognized by the Anglican churches in the South, in Global South. But now that there is one, you guys discern together, do we want to continue or do we want to join this new movement, even though we don't necessarily agree with everything they're doing? Do we stand with them on the core teachings of the gospel? And you guys and council together agreed to do that, and you joined Cana East, which is a dual jurisdiction of the ACNA and the Church of Nigeria. So that's why we're here, and that's why we call ourselves members of this province nationally, because this is the province which our global partners recognize and are supporting. And so I urge you to pray for the ACNA as we wrestle through these questions. I've included in your packet on page 53, which we won't spend too much time going over now, this what's called the Fundamental Declarations of the Province. And this is from the ACNA Constitution, so it's the highest canon law for our church nationally. And these are the fundamental declarations. These are the things that, on a doctrinal principle, the ACNA is committed to. And I invite you to read this and compare this to the Jerusalem Declaration, because they're very clearly mirroring that document and saying that we're committed to this. And I have it on good authority that when the ACNA does finally produce their own prayer book, they're going to include right alongside the Articles of Religion, the Jerusalem Declaration as one of their core documents. In fact, the Church of Nigeria has already done that. They published their own now indigenous prayer book of the Church of Nigeria in 2009 or something. And right after the Articles of Religion is the Jerusalem Declaration. So people are taking this statement very, very seriously as the basis of fellowship. Bishop Julian requires all the clergy in his diocese to submit to the Jerusalem Declaration. So we read it not as a historical document in the abstract, but as a document that has real, continuing, abiding force for this global realignment, which is happening in an effort to revitalize Anglicanism and restore it to its own roots. And I pray and hope that it will succeed, but time will tell, and unfortunately things are still messy. And as much as I wish I could tell you the story has a happy ending, I mean, of course, ultimately it will when Christ returns in glory and restores his church and presents it to himself pure and spotless. We believe that as Christians. But in terms of the Anglican communion, I think it does have a potentially very bright future. But some of these issues still need to be sorted out. And I invite you to pray for the GAFCON primates and for the GAFCON provinces around the world that they will remain faithful to this standard and that they will encourage us to remain faithful to the standard. And so with that, I'll close and take questions. Michael. I'm sorry? The individual provinces do. So they elect according to their own rules, their own delegates. It usually involves episcopal. So I think the ACC defines the number of delegates that a church gets. Like you have X number of bishop slots, X number of clergy slots, which is non-bishop clergy, and then an X number of lay slots. And that's based on the size of your church. To a certain extent, that's become lopsided because the Episcopal Church is still overly represented on that body because of just historic circumstances. But you guys can elect delegates to fill these spots however you choose. And that's how they're elected.
It seems on its face very strange that the primates don't have authority over that body.
Over the ACC?
Because within their own diocese, they have authority over those individuals. As soon as those individuals go to this meeting, they have their own separate total authority.
Yeah, well, depending on the... Because Anglican provinces are all a little different. And so in Nigeria, for example, the primate is very, very powerful. Whereas in the United States, the primate of the Episcopal Church, the presiding bishop, is not nearly as powerful. And so individual bishops have much more sovereignty in their own diocese. And that's just because of the histories of these provinces and how they came to be. But so in theory, to your point, you know, a primate in a church may have authority over his delegates or his delegation. But once they get to the ACC, this thing is governed by its own rules and its own constitution. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the Anglican Church in North America does include a jurisdiction in Canada. That's the reason why it's the Anglican Church in North America, is because the Canadians are also with us. There's also, we also have a few churches in Mexico as well. Yeah, Laura. Sure. And I think the way his first among equals works itself out in practice is that he has pretty prominent roles in all of these bodies. So obviously he's the one who invites people to Lambeth, so he has a pretty prominent role there. He chairs this body, so he's got a pretty prominent role there. And he chairs the primates meeting as well. And he's been given that authority because of his just historic prerogative, because he's the head of the Mother Church. But one of the things I know that Bishop Julian has advocated for as a potential means for reform within the communion is that the primacy of some of these bodies actually rotates. So it's not always the Archbishop of Canterbury. It might be the Archbishop of Nigeria. I doubt that'll happen, but that's one idea that's been floated. Yeah, Eric. No, officially as of right now, when I said, I was kind of joking at the beginning of our talk, there are kind of two Anglican communions. GAFCON is trying to recruit more provinces to join their ranks, and they've had some success in that regard. There was a major moment of symbolic solidarity when the first archbishop of the ACNA, a man named Bob Duncan, retired, and he was replaced by a new man named Foley Beach, who is still currently in that role. And there were 8 primates of the Anglican Communion there to consecrate him. And they laid hands on him, and they said, "We declare you to be a primate within the Anglican Communion." All right, so these are primates of some of the largest churches in the communion, but conspicuously, England wasn't one of the primates that was there. The archbishop wasn't there. So the ACNA is recognized by the GAFCON provinces as the Anglican Church here in North America. As far as these instruments are concerned, though, we're not. But they recognize the Episcopal Church. But they recognize Nigeria, and that's part of the problem. Nigeria is still represented on these bodies. Of course, Nigeria boycotts these meetings now because it's just hopeless from their point of view. And they still continue to call England to public account. But they've basically now created a new sort of relationship outside of these instruments with new provinces. Interestingly enough, though, just a couple weeks ago, the Church of England passed a canon at their synod which officially recognized the orders of all ACNA clergy as valid. And so it's sort of a tacit recognition that we're, whatever they'd like to say about it, legitimately Anglican, but they're not yet able to be in full communion with us. And the situation in England, unfortunately, is not that great. There's still a lot of conservatives within the Church of England, but the Church of England itself is increasingly compromised in its own witness, and I could go on at length about that. I won't for now, but did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Catherine, you had your hand raised with some... Yeah.
How large is the Episcopal Church today and the Church of England today as opposed to next year?
Yes, this is one way in which the books get cooked, right? Because the Episcopal Church, I think officially, they have somewhere around 2 million members. But as a friend of mine who was baptized Episcopalian but has spent the rest of his life as a Presbyterian, is now an ordained Presbyterian member, a minister, a friend of mine from seminary, he cannot get his home parish to take his name off their membership rolls. And so the Episcopal Church reports a membership of around 2 million, but the number of people who actually show up on Sunday is only around 600,000. Within England, it's even more dire. I think they have a membership officially of like 24 million, so I think they're still officially the largest province of the communion. But the number of people actually showing up for worship in Church of England parishes has dropped below 1 million in the last year for the first time in history. And so the number of people who show up on Sunday is significantly below what they're reporting as their membership. Now, Nigeria, they report 20 million people, and on Sunday, about 20 million people show up for church. So their membership numbers align pretty closely with active membership. The ACNA has an active membership of around 130. Of course, now that South Carolina has joined us, we're probably closer to around 160,000 now. And our average Sunday attendance is probably somewhere around 130, give or take. Yeah. Yes, so Lambeth, the next Lambeth, because it's every 10 years, it was a conference in 2008, so the next Lambeth conference would have been 2018. That conference was canceled or indefinitely postponed because the Archbishop of Canterbury didn't want the bad press of a bunch of bishops not showing up. But after the meeting in 2016 in London that they had, he decided to reconvene that council for 2020, but I doubt any of the GAFCON bishops will go because... When that meeting in 2016 called in a moratorium for the Episcopal Church and its members having voice and vote on this council, and then 2 months later they were seated with a full voice and vote, the GAFCON primates felt that was a pretty fundamental betrayal of what they had agreed to. And so I doubt they'll go to Lambeth 2020. Yeah, Sherry.
So, in a very basic, practical way.
Yeah. It depends. I mean, there are still some conservatives.
What's the relationship like generally in those two groups?
It's pretty strained.
Very strained.
Yeah. There are still some conservatives in the Episcopal Church fighting it out. I mean, there are not many of them now, but there are still some. And so it's not fair to just, if you're Episcopalian, you're automatically a heretic. There are still some very faithful people who are committed to sort of trying to win the day still. The odds are very grim, but they're there, and you should pray for them. When we were in Pennsylvania, Christchurch Anglican on the main line was surrounded within 5 minutes in every direction by five Episcopal parishes. None of them liked us very much, actually. And so my effort to reach out to those clergy was mostly rebuffed. There was one conservative Episcopal church in that area called Church of the Good Samaritan. And one of their associate priests really did his college best to befriend me, and I give him credit for that. His rector, however, was very suspicious of us, even though he was himself a conservative. He's British and has a hard time understanding these realignments because British people are above all committed to stability, sometimes at the expense of honesty. And so I would just say, as a general rule, there are still some relationships that cross those lines, Sherry. And if you have friends in the Episcopal Church, I encourage you to continue to be friends with them. But certainly at official levels, they're extremely, I mean, we're in schism. They're strained.
The same thing with our ACNA churches in the United States and Episcopal?
Oh, by a ways. I mean, the Episcopal Church has been around for 200 some odd years, so they've been around for 200 some odd years, so they've got parishes everywhere. Yeah, globally, there's a lot more conservative Anglicans than liberal ones, but here in the U.S., we are outnumbered. But demographically, the Episcopal Church continues to shrink every year, and the ACNA continues to grow. So in the 5 years after our founding, the ACNA planted 480 congregations. In that same amount of time, the Episcopal Church planted one nationally. So growth is pretty one-sided. And I suspect those trends to continue. I mean, the Episcopal parish here in town has a dozen and a half people that show up on Sunday, whereas, you see what we're like here at Holy Trinity, so... Yeah. Does that answer your question? Yeah, the ACNA actually has a Church Finder app where you can see, there's like a map and you can see where all the churches are. Yeah. Any other questions? Holy Trinity was only just added to that map last year, actually. Any other questions? Yeah, Luke. Yes, so there is now an organization called GAFCON UK. Most of the members of that organization are actually still within the Church of England. The situation in England is very complex because of the way that church is integrated into that society, right? Because it's still the established church. And so even though most Britons don't show up there on Sunday anymore, being a Church of England vicar carries with it certain social privileges and obligations. So oftentimes the local vicar's on the local school board, that kind of stuff. And so, and because of just the British sentiments and British tenet, like the way just British people are, there's been more of an unwillingness to formally break ranks with official structures. But in the last few months, a number of things have happened, and I'm starting to see conservatives still within the Church of England voice their opposition to what's going on there more loudly than I've seen them do before. And so things are kind of coming to a head in England. I suspect it'll still be a few years before we see significant movement there, but England is also a little bit of a mess. Yeah. GAFCON UK, though, I understand, consists of representatives of... It's mostly people who are still in the Church of England. Any other questions? Well, let me conclude on this point, because I've shared all this to you, and the worry in sharing all this to you is that you'll get discouraged. Things are bad, and people are abandoning the faith, and the church is splitting up, and what are we going to do? And that's an understandable feeling to have, because it is tragic what's happened. People have denied the faith. That's a serious problem. But aside from all of these fancy instruments, and aside even from the Jerusalem Declaration and the fancy things that these bishops say when they get together, there's one undeniable fact that we as Christians have to cleave to above all else, and that is that Christ preserves his church. All right? So we talk about these things. Let's not forget that the church, apart from all the secretariats and all the endowed cathedrals in the world, the church is fundamentally an eternal institution. Right? It's the body of Jesus. And Jesus is God at the right hand of his Father in heaven. And so he's not going to, like, you know, fall asleep at the switch on his church. He's promised to preserve his church. He has not promised that his church won't face trial. He has not even promised that his church won't face serious division. Paul at one point says that God has sent the divisions to test your faith. Right? So of course Christ prays for the unity of the church. But he's never promised the church that it would be unblemished in this age. He has, however, promised us, and we believe this, we confess it every Sunday with the Nicene Creed, that he will, when he returns in glory, present his church spotless to himself. Right? And we believe this as Christians. And one of the things about these GAFCON bishops that's so encouraging to me is that it's clear that even though they're fighting for Anglicanism as sort of a tradition of Christian faith, at a more fundamental level still, they're fighting for the gospel of Jesus. And they've, especially recently, they've tried to play down a little bit those Anglican things, which of course they're Anglicans, so they're not hiding that fact. They're concerned about the gospel's faithful proclamation, and they're committed to that. Of course, we're Anglicans. That's the boat we fish out of, you might say, in our mission for as we fish for men. But we're disciples of Jesus first, and he will preserve his church. No matter how bad it may look to us down here, his Spirit is present among us when his word is faithfully preached and his sacrament is duly celebrated. And I believe that's true. And so even though it grieves my heart to see the church divided the way it is, I have to have confidence that despite all of our failings, which we contribute to the mess, let's just be honest, Christ himself nevertheless promises to preserve his church. And if we believe in him, we have to believe that he will. Amen?
Amen.
Amen. So with that, this series concludes, and I thank you all for taking the time to journey through all this with me. God bless you.